So the topic today, right, to sit down. The topic today is the perfection of philosophy and religion. And it's being conducted at the Assumption University. Is it? Assumption means we have some assumption. How did that name come?
It's the holiness of Mary.
Ah, that assumption, I see. All right. Yeah. Okay. Philosophy and religion, there's one department here, is it? Philosophy and religion, yeah. Religion is often or generally assumed to be a kind of faith. If we see the dictionary definition of religion, we'll see a kind of faith. But actual religion must be based on philosophy. Otherwise, it's only sentimentalism or sectarianism, dogmatism or fanaticism. Philosophy comes from the Greek philosophia, love of truth. So if we are to discuss philosophy, then there are some assumptions. We have to make some assumption, some basic assumption that there is truth, that we don't know the truth, otherwise we wouldn't be studying philosophy. And that the truth can be understood, otherwise there would be no point in studying philosophy. So these are some basic assumptions. There is truth, that we don't know it, and that it can be understood. Now, some people have the philosophy that there is no ultimate truth, or that it cannot be known, or that even if there is truth, it cannot be known, it is unknowable. But then that's not actually philosophy, that's anti-philosophy. That if there is no truth, there's no ultimate principle, then there's no use to discuss anything. If there's no ultimate existence, if there's no ultimate meaning to anything, then we should stop all thinking and probably all acting. If we say that there's no ultimate truth, everything is meaningless. Of course, we can say this, but that doesn't stop us eating our rice 3 times a day. If everything's meaningless, then we should, why eat? Why do anything? If we say everything's meaningless, then we should stop eating, stop breathing. Why do anything? Just don't exist. Or if we say there is no existence, then why do we try to maintain our bodily existence? Factually, even someone who's not in the slightest bit philosophical, even the animals, accept that there is meaning, at least at the level of eating. In the Upanishadic description, this first stage of philosophical understanding is called annamaya, that we perceive reality as food. It's the lowest level of existence. There's not really any thought, but we're interested in ahara nidra bhayamaitun, eating, sleeping, sex. And we also experience fear, which leads us to fear at various levels, leads us to conform to social norms, leads us to speak spitefully of others, as nations leads us to make armies and wars. These are basic animal principles. But that we pursue eating, we try to arrange for eating, shelter. Even the animals, they do this, so that it, there is meaning in that. It's not a very high level, but it is an attempt to interact with or adjust with the environment in a manner that we perceive as being favorable to our self-interest. So everyone is pursuing meaning, either thinking about it, either willfully or non-willfully. Everyone is pursuing meaning at the lowest level, that is simply eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. The philosopher or the philosophical person means someone who wants to find out the ultimate meaning. What is the ultimate meaning of existence? Is there more to existence than eating, sleeping, mating, and defending? Ahara nidra bhaya maitunam cha samanyam etat pashubhyanaranam. Animals also eat, sleep, mate, and defend. So in that sense, the humans are not different. But dharmo hitesham adhiko vishesham dharmena hina pashubhyanaranam. But dharma, which is, for lack of a better word, translated in English as religion. In Thai there are two words. Tam means dharma and sasana means religion. But dharma doesn't really mean either of these terms. It's a comprehensive term. So dharma, or the endeavor to understand the highest truth, that is the ultimate meaning of dharma, that is possible for humans, not for animals. Therefore, a human being who does not attempt to better himself, to understand the ultimate meaning of existence, is no better than an animal. Even if we have skyscraper buildings, monorail, metro, new airports, and so on, we are no better than animals if we do not attempt to understand the meaning of life beyond eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. So I was quoting just now some Sanskrit verse from the Vedic literature. So we may say, well, this is a sectarian, now I'm promoting a sectarian outlook. But actually this is not sectarian. This is a universal principle. It's not that because it's spoken in Sanskrit that it's Hindu. Hinduism or any ism is, these are all different concepts or sets of concepts. But truth or reality that is to be discovered through philosophy, that is beyond any ism. We, from our restricted perspective, we require, or we feel that we require to put everything into some box or category, this ism, that ism. But of course, reality, or truth, or meaning is beyond any isms that we concoct. And the great, for want of a better term, religious teachers, they come to teach us the truth, due to our inability to grasp that truth, we wrap it up in boxes and call it this ism and that ism. This Sanskrit verse which I quoted, it's a universal principle. It's not a Hindu principle. That, or it's an observation, that eating, sleeping, mating and defending are bodily activities which human beings and animals have in common. But that in the human form of life, there is the opportunity for going beyond this to a higher principle. Therefore, a human being who does not do so is no better than an animal. So human life is especially meant for understanding what is the ultimate truth, ultimate meaning. Religion is generally taken as a means to improve our eating, sleeping, mating and defending. Therefore, religion, just to discuss religion, is not very, in the way it's conventionally understood, is not very helpful. People pray for blessings so that they can improve their material situation. They can have improved eating, sleeping, mating and defending. This is not the perfection of religion. This is materialistic religion. It's a beginning. At least it recognizes that there is power beyond us that we have to supplicate. But that is not the perfection of religion. It's not the perfection of religion means to, first of all, we should understand what is the truth, what are we aiming at? The means to realize that and factually enter into that. Again, in the Vedic language, I'm quoting the Vedic language, but please don't think I'm promoting any sectarian religion. You can consider for yourself if what is being spoken are universal principles or not. If not, you can fault me afterwards. So the Vedic perspective. One point I want to say, it's not sectarian, but we can consider that at least previously in the land that is now known as India, these topics were taken very seriously. Discussion of philosophy was taken very seriously, and not just as an intellectual exercise, but because the culture was such that it was understood that human life is meant for understanding the highest truth. So it was taken very seriously, and high level of philosophical discussion was quite common. Nowadays, it's difficult to find anyone in India or outside India who's even interested in these things. But that was common. I was saying also, you had kindly introduced my fallen self as a great something or other. But that is a sign of the great culture that is going on here in Thailand today. The great culture of recognizing that a person who is more concerned with religion, the highest truth, than with eating, sleeping, mating and defending is a person to be respected. That is respectable. It's more respectable than money, power, position, all these things, is the position of one who is engaged in the genuine search for the highest truth. So, the Vedic exposition of philosophy and religion, they're not separated. The two, it's not, they're different compartments, philosophy and religion. Philosophy means religion, and religion means philosophy, ultimately. So that is perceived in three stages. First of all, philosophy means to understand the interaction of everything. What is everything, and what is everything's relation to everything else? What's going on? What's going on in the world? Now, that can be taken at a physical level. Practically all subjects which are studied in universities, they're concerned with the interaction of various principles. Mathematics means the interaction of numbers. Physics means the interaction of energies. Biology means the interaction of organic substances. History means the study of the past interactions of human society. Politics means the interactions of various persons' machinations for power and social organization. So the subject which is the study of the interaction of everything is philosophy. What is the relation of everything, of each individual entity to everything else? What is the relationship of everything? How does it all come together? And where do we fit? Where do I fit? In philosophy, if we say this, it's the love of truth or search for truth, then that means individuals are searching for it. So an individual person is an individual philosopher. So what is my relationship with everything? It is an individual quest. So then the next question comes, well, having understood that, there should be some practical activity. Otherwise, it's only intellectualism. We hear of armchair philosophers. They will sit and discuss, just like, do we exist or don't we exist? Which is, this is a meaningless question. Because the question whether we exist or whether we don't exist, that stops at mealtimes. Because whether we exist or whether we don't exist becomes subordinated to the need for food. So that is an admission that we exist. Something exists that requires some food. So at the very least, we exist at the physical level. Of course, philosophy means to go beyond the physical level. How to do that? Having understood philosophically what is my relationship with everything? Now, there are various schools of philosophy. Some will say that the individual ultimately is everything, or the individual ultimately doesn't exist. Or the individual is supreme. Or the individual is part of the supreme. The individual is subordinate to the supreme. There are various philosophical perspectives. However, if we are to understand the truth, then we should know that it's not a matter of opinion. Some philosophers say, well, all opinions are as good as each other. They're all representative. They're all different aspects of the truth. But that, again, is a killing of philosophy. That's not philosophy. If we say that all opinions are as good as each other, then that means there's no ultimate truth. Then that means that there's no ultimate meaning. Then why do we as human beings, even search for meaning. The very fact that we search for meaning, that we presume that there is meaning in science, in mathematics, in social organization, in language, there's meaning. And the search for ultimate meaning suggests that it is there. Otherwise, why should we desire to pursue it at all? It's not just a matter of opinion. There are certain, in any discipline, there are certain specifics which are to be understood, that this is correct and this is not correct. In arithmetic, the child first of all learns 1 + 1 = 2. Now that is a fact. It's not a matter of opinion. It's not that in Buddhism 1 + 1, well, in Buddhism 1 + 1 = 0. But in arithmetic 1 + 1 = 2. You can't change that. It's not a matter of opinion. It's a fact. If at all we're to study arithmetic, then 1 + 1 always equals 2. 2 + 2 always equals 4. If at all we are to study geography, then Bangkok, Krung Thep, is the capital of Thailand. Now we may say that, well, in my opinion, Chiang Mai is the capital of Thailand. Maybe your opinion, but it's not a fact. You may desire that, but it's not a fact. There are certain facts. Otherwise, there's no study of anything unless there are certain facts which are to be ascertained and to be understood. So if we say that all opinions are the same or there's no ultimate meaning, then there's no need to study philosophy and the search for meaning is meaningless. But again, this is not actual philosophy. Although some people who say that there's no ultimate meaning, they churn out dozens of books to explain why everything has no meaning. So but what's the need? Then just sit at home and watch football on the TV. Well, even that's got some meaning. Meaningless as it may be, we ascribe meaning to it. It has no ultimate meaning. That in a game of football, they have ascribed meaning to the movement of a ball from one end of a pitch to another. So it is an ascribed meaning. It has no ultimate meaning. But if we are to search for the truth, then we should accept that there is some ultimate reality. So, what is that? Philosophy means to find out what is ultimate reality, and then we have what is our need for that? How to connect with that? What is our lacking? At the present time, in our present situation, we perceive our lacking. We are searching for the truth. We perceive that we do not know what is the truth. We feel incomplete. We feel dissatisfied. And actually, in material existence, we should feel dissatisfied. That is intelligent. Because ahara nidra bhaya maitun, the bodily activities of eating, sleeping, mating and defending, they lead to another set of, or they are enacted within and prolong another set of 4, janma, mrityu, jara, vyadhi, birth, death, old age and disease. These are the inevitable factors of material existence. That we may try to find meaning and happiness in a life of eating, sleeping, mating and defending. But ultimately, we have to accept death, rebirth, old age, disease. This is miserable. There are so many miseries in material life. They are also analyzed in three categories. Adhyatmik klesh, adhibhautik klesh, adhidaivik klesh, which means miseries pertaining to the body and mind. Sometimes it's too hot. Sometimes, not often in Bangkok, but sometimes it's too cold. We perceive that. We have diseases. We have anxiety, anger. So these are all miseries pertaining to the mind and body. Then there's miseries caused by other living beings. Mosquitoes are biting. Politicians are oppressing. Someone is shouting at us. Someone is driving in a way that causes us distress. So there are miseries caused by other living beings. And adhidaivik klesh, natural disturbances such as floods, earthquakes, tsunami, or just like that, too hot, too cold, like this. So this material existence is miserable. Nevertheless, every living being is trying to be happy. Why? The philosopher should consider that the search for ultimate happiness suggests that there is ultimate happiness. Just as the experience of thirst suggests that our body has a need for water, and there is water. The experience of hunger suggests that our body needs food, and there is food. So the experience of insufficiency or dissatisfaction, that we want ultimate happiness, satisfaction, peace, suggests that it is available. But certainly in material existence, all our attempts for happiness through friendship, whatever, through friendship, love, eating, sleeping, sports, and so on and so on. There are thousands and thousands of ways that we attempt to be happy. Even some people, that's considered a perversity. They try to be happy by giving misery to others. They perceive happiness as making others unhappy. Or they may even perceive happiness as giving suffering to themselves. It's a very strange kind of happiness. But all these kinds of happiness, even love in this material world, it's all incomplete and imperfect. Even if we think, I will marry my dream girl and we shall live happily ever after, but it's all just a dream because we don't live happily ever after. It might be 1 or 2 days after the marriage, or it might be even throughout life, but death is the limiting factor. Everything is limited by time. So that we desire full, complete, uninterrupted, perfect happiness suggests that there is full, complete, perfect happiness, but that it's not available in this material world suggests that we have to seek it in another place or beyond the activities of eating, sleeping, mating, defending, And that may also encompass sports, art, science, music. Beyond material or mundane, urbane existence, there is happiness beyond that. Ultimately, we are all happiness-seeking creatures. But we are not finding happiness in material existence. So, nevertheless, we, the philosopher, perceives that there is meaning. So there must be some ultimate meaning. And the ultimate meaning should be something good. Should be good, all goodness, all happiness, all beauty, all truth. These are the in the higher level of human consciousness, we desire truth, beauty, justice, mercy, all these good qualities. It's written that this department is wanting to impart philosophy and religion for the uplift of human society. These qualities are desired in human society: mercy, truth, justice, beauty, and so on. But ultimately, these qualities exist in their perfection beyond any mundane state. All truth, beauty, justice, etc. in material existence, that cannot be perfect and cannot be complete, because material existence, by its very nature, is imperfect and incomplete. Therefore, we come to metaphysics, or the search for that which is beyond birth and death. Now, how are we to perceive that? How are we to perceive that which is beyond the ordinary? What is the method to perceive that? If we are to contact the ultimate truth, how are we to do so? Because we are limited. Our perceptions are limited. Our concepts are limited. We are all conditioned by the upbringing we have had, by the experiences and the education we have had. Just like here in a Buddhist country, where if we are to discuss philosophy and religion, we can expect so many questions will come up in terms of Buddhism. Yes, but you said this, but in Buddhism it's stated like this. And if we, even though I'm trying to speak in a non-sectarian manner, speaking about the basic principles of philosophy and religion that transcend all times, all mundane times, places and circumstances, but everyone tends to perceive in the terms of what they've learned and what their experiences are. So in a Buddhist country, we'll get questions in terms of Buddhism. In an Islamic country, we'll get questions in terms of Islam. In a Christian country,
from Hinduism,
you'll get questions in terms of Hinduism. Or what people perceive or consider to be Hinduism, Buddhism, or whatever. So, ultimately the truth is beyond, as I was saying, beyond all these isms. And it's beyond any mundane way of thinking. So how are we to, this is the problem then for philosophers, how to break through that. How to come to the transcendent level, that which transcends mundane thought In the Vedic literature, again, it's said that there are three limits. Of course, there are three limiting factors. They are time, space, and thought. We are limited by time. We perceive ourselves as products of the 21st century. We perceive ourselves as products of the world in which we presently live. And so these are limiting factors on our consciousness. And thought are the accumulated thought patterns by which we think. Education, what is that? That is teaching us how to think. A liberal education is supposed to help people to think independently. But any educational system must be an imposition on a person's thought patterns. You have to teach people how to think in some way or other. It's not possible to be absolutely non-sectarian. Education means there has to be some discipline, some teaching people how to think, how to perceive in certain ways. But ultimate reality is beyond our preconceptions. So how to go, inevitably we are thinking into, I am from Thailand, I am a Buddhist, or I am from India, I am a Hindu. How to go beyond all these preconceptions and come to ultimate truth? Well, I've been quoting the Vedic literature, and I will continue to do so. Ved means vidya. Within the Vedic literature itself, vidya means knowledge. Within the Vedic literature itself, it's stated that there are two kinds of vidya. One is ordinary knowledge, aparavidya, and another kind of knowledge is paravidya. That means knowledge, transcendent knowledge, beyond our preconceptions. There is truth as it exists, not subject to our perceptions of it. Truth is independent. Even material truths are independent of our preconceptions. Just like 1 + 1 = 2 is not a matter of opinion. It's a fact. We can argue that, but then we go outside the scope of accepted reality. Of course, there may be different opinions, but there are certain facts we have to accept if we are at all to conceptualize anything. So that there is ultimate meaning is suggested by everything around us. That we walk in the door where the door says A101. We don't attempt to walk through the wall. Means that there is an accepted order. We feel hunger and we eat rice. We don't eat garbage in the street. We need something in our stomach, but we put in rice, we don't put garbage. The garbage would also fill the space in the stomach. But we act according to the accepted order. So order is there, but the order that we find on the material platform and our attempts to act within that order to attain happiness ultimately brings us frustration. Then how to come to ultimate meaning, and what is that ultimate meaning? So the Vedic literature discusses this. Now, I've been trying to present this as non-sectarian, and I'll go on doing so. But I'm going to quote the Vedic literature more to discuss this. Because if... How are we to make this jump from perceived reality to that which is beyond our preconceptions, the ultimate truth. How are we going to do that? There must be some link between the transcendent and our present situation. There must be some means of communication. Just like the teacher teaches. If it's mathematics, he teaches. 1 + 1 = 2 and on and on and on. There's communication. Someone knows and someone doesn't know. He who knows, he tries to impart that knowledge to others. And that knowledge which he has, which is at the present time, beyond the understanding of the student, the teacher, he understands that clearly and can impart it to the student. This is the system of imparting knowledge. So the system of imparting knowledge of that which is beyond our mundane preconceptions and which brings us to the level of ultimate reality, that is also communicable. That knowledge exists and it is understandable. If it was not understandable, then why should we have the desire to understand it? Just like if the in the cosmos, we see there are so many needs and there is fulfillment of that need. There's the need for, we feel the need for water, we have thirst, there is water. Is there a need to take photos just now? There are conflicting needs. Philosophy is getting more complex. Let's keep it simple. Photos later, if you don't mind. There's also a need to keep nice relationships, so I won't shout at you. So, there's thirst, there is water. Hunger, there is food. So, the desire for ultimate happiness, how to attain that, that should be, if we're not attaining that, that someone should know. And that should be communicable also. Of course, there's a very high level of knowledge and not everyone may be eligible to understand that. Just like 1 + 1 = 2, pretty much everyone is eligible to understand that. But then when we go higher and higher, algebra, geometry, trigonometry, calculus, and on and on and on, then it requires that some primary education, some ability, some interest, and it requires a competent teacher. So this, in the Vedic literature, this highest knowledge, the Vedas, or that purports to give the highest knowledge, to give that knowledge which is beyond the knowledge of eating, sleeping, mating and defending, ultimate knowledge. It purports to give that, but at the same time, it requires a competent teacher to teach it and a competent student to understand it. So the knowledge is given within the Vedas, but just like you cannot become a mathematician by picking up a book on higher, you cannot become a professor of mathematics just by picking up a book. It requires, one has to study from age 5 and then go study year after year after year after year and be guided at each step. And then ultimately one can enter into the higher level. And the higher you go, the less students there are. How many atomic physicists are there in the world? Not so many are eligible to understand. So to understand this highest truth, that requires certain eligibility. That is described in the Vedic literature. And the Vedic literature also describes that apart from the highest reality, which not everyone is ready to come to, there are various levels. And therefore, just like in the school, there's the first grade, second grade, third grade, and the mathematics that is taught or whatever subject, is progressively higher. So within this world, we see different manifestations of what are called religion. And they're all meant for the ultimate truth. But it is taught at various levels according to different persons' level of eligibility. Now, we're using an example of mathematics. What may seem true at one level of mathematics may be untrue at another level. Or physics. What is true at one level, Newtonian physics, is true, but at a higher level, one has to come to quantum physics. Or in mathematics, an axiom is that there's no square root of a negative integer. But when it's not possible, because if you multiply a negative integer by another negative integer, then it automatically becomes non-negative, becomes positive. But in higher mathematics, it's possible. It's not understandable to those who are on a lower level, but it's not only possible, but it's necessary for solving certain mathematical problems at a higher level. So there are various levels of religion also. And they are propagated within the world by various teachers for the uplift of human society so that people can gradually come to a higher level. Now that may take many lifetimes. Of course, in some religions, in some religious systems, they don't accept that we have many lifetimes. Although this can be understood to be a religion being taught in the infant level, that there's only one life, and then you're created, and then you live, and then you die, and then you're judged on the basis of one life, and then everything's finished. This is not very, if we consider philosophically, this is not very satisfactory theology. Whatever you do in one life, and then you're judged forever. And usually, according to the religions who say this, most people, according to their theological outlook, are burned in hell forever for the mistakes you make in one life. But rather, understanding this highest truth, it's not such an easy thing that it can be understood in one life, and may take many lifetimes, so. Rather, we have many chances for a gradual development. So what is the highest truth? Well, to understand the highest truth, first of all, there's some eligibility required. And eligibility begins at the beginning of religion. What is the beginning of religion? First, we should become qualified at the lower level, then we can become qualified at the higher level. To try to bring people immediately to the higher level without bring them to the step by step, it won't be very successful. To teach atomic physics to infants who have not studied multiplication will not be successful. So the Vedic literature teaches that, first of all, the principles of dharma. What are the basic principles of dharma that are required to become eligible? Eligibility for this knowledge is not simply based on intellectual capacity, but is based on purification of one's existence. One who leads a pure life can understand the ultimate truth, which means that which is pure, that which is beyond contamination. So to understand that which is the ultimate purity, the highest reality, requires that one become purified in one's eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. These activities are animalistic One should become pure. One's eating, sleeping, mating, and defending should become purified. Everything should become purified. So the basic principles of religion are mercy, cleanliness, austerity, and truthfulness. These four principles. Mercy, of course, this is very broad. This is paralleled in the teachings of the Buddha, some basic principles. Mercy means that we should have right speed, right action, right thought. We should not behave with others in a way that will bring them distress. So this mercy can be at various levels also. One important factor is that if we are to be merciful, then we should not indulge in animal slaughter, meat eating, because this gives pain, severe pain, to the creatures who are slaughtered. Now we may say that, well, if we eat vegetable foods, we have to eat something. So vegetable foods, that also requires killing. Actually, not necessarily. Grains are harvested after they are biologically dead. Taking fruit from the tree does not kill the tree. Some vegetables are taken by killing them. That's true. But even then, because the consciousness in the vegetable form of life is so much less than that in the animal or fish or bird species, there's much less pain involved. So an important part of mercy, by which the consciousness can become purified to understand higher knowledge, is that one should not indulge in eating foods which are taken by violence, causing pain, severe pain. So, mercy, cleanliness. Cleanliness means bodily cleanliness and clean in our actions. That means not corrupt. And clean in thought. We should not desire harm for others. We should not desire to exploit others. It's not such an easy thing. It's relatively easy to keep the body clean by bathing regularly, brushing the teeth. But keeping the thoughts clean, that's not very easy. The desires to exploit others, or bad feelings towards others, these are unclean thoughts. But one has to cultivate cleanliness in bodily, physical cleanliness, cleanliness in action, and cleanliness in thought. So, next is austerity, principle of religion. Means that we should not cultivate, or rather than cultivating sense enjoyment, we should know that sense enjoyment is that which entangles us in birth, death, old age, and disease. So, karma, desire, you also say that in Thai, is it? Kama, something like that. I can't remember. It's a long time since I spoke Thai. So that entangles us. So austerity means that activity by which we remove ourselves from sense enjoyment. We rather than cultivating sense enjoyment, we cultivate abnegation of sense enjoyment and truthfulness. One should practice speaking the truth. On the higher level, truthfulness means not simply speaking the truth, but living for the truth. So these are basic principles of religion. And by cultivating these, we come from the philosophical platform to the practical platform. That philosophy means to understand what is our relationship with the truth. And religion means to act according to that. Philosophy should not be just armchair philosophy, that you have some opinion and you think about it and you discuss it, and it's just a matter of intellectual fun, intellectual enjoyment. But it should be practical. Philosophy has its practical application. So there are various philosophies in the world. Communism was a prominent philosophy during the 20th century that was seen to be ultimately a failure. Unspokenly, the philosophy of the modern world, because in the modern world there's not much philosophy. There's Tom and Jerry and football games and Coca-Cola and not much philosophy. So the unspoken philosophy, whether we propagate it or conceptualize it or not, everyone has some philosophy. So the philosophy of the modern world, even though it's not spoken, it's not clearly expressed or even understood. But the philosophy... Time's up? This should be a break question, yeah. Okay, I have to wrap it up. All right, how to speak the philosophy of the whole truth in 2 seconds. Hare Krishna. That's it. Anyway, we'll... So the philosophy of the modern world is eat, sleep, drink, be merry, and enjoy, for tomorrow we shall all be dead. That's it. Vedic philosophy means tomorrow we shall not be dead. The body will be dead. But if we simply eat, sleep, drink, be merry, and enjoy, then our next life will not be very good. It will not help us to... Even this life is not very good. So, we got somewhere, and now it's time for a break. Well, we shouldn't take a break from understanding the highest truth, but we shouldn't ever take a break, ever. Our whole life should be for that, life after life. But we require a break, so I have to wrap this up. I'm just coming in there. Anyway, the ultimate truth can be... Anyway, I'm making so many jumps at every sentence because at every step of this discussion, we could stop and discuss for hours. But we have to make some jump because we have to try and wrap up everything in an hour or so. Anyway, that the ultimate truth is Satyam Shivam Sundaram. This is the Vedic language. It is real. True, it is not a figment of the imagination. And satyam means that it is eternal. It is an eternal truth. It is shivam, it is all good. Reality is good. Ultimately, goodness prevails. And sundaram, beauty. The ultimate truth is all goodness, all perfection, all truth, all beauty. Well, how are we to find that? Not by any... It's not the mountain of understanding the truth. We cannot climb it by our ability. We are limited. So that knowledge has to come down. We have to be informed about that. So the Vedic literature teaches us that the ultimate truth, beauty, reality, all goodness is the Supreme Person, not exactly God according to the Semitic concept. Not exactly God. God is a term, again, it has certain term, certain preconceptions that goes with it. The ultimate truth is Krishna. But Krishna is not God as he is conventionally understood. He's God and more. You may say, well, God is everything. Yeah, but our understanding of everything is so limited. So God, or Krishna, is the ultimate truth. He is the ultimate object of love, ultimate beauty. We all have our relationship with him. To act in that relationship is the purification of our existence. That is religion. And ultimate religion means to enter the eternal existence of loving relationship with Krishna. So, all right, time for a break. And I made a big jump at the end there, so we can have questions and answers about that later. Thank you for listening so patiently. It's rare in the world to find a person so patient to hear about such topics.
Thank you very much.
We have been talking about being universal, but all philosophical systems, religious systems, which we know about, whom you call as beginners, they also talk about universal. So what is the difference between your universal talk and their universal talk?
Yeah, I'm speaking of universal principles, and all other religions or philosophies claim to be universal. So there can't be plurality of universalism. So what's the difference between the universalism I'm speaking of and the universalism that others speak of? Well, that's why I was attempting to present in a philosophical manner rather than a sectarian or what could be considered a religious manner. Even though I was quoting from the Vedic literature, I was not saying that this is something you have to accept just on faith, but applying reason also. Reason and belief are not necessarily contradictory principles. So I was speaking on principles that we can all observe and understand, just like eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. We can see that it's not a question of whether one belongs to this religion or that religion, but these are the basic principles of life in this material world. That whether one is in a human body or a non-human body. And that animals and humans have these in common, it is stated in the Vedic literature, but even if it's not stated in the Vedic literature, it's a fact. That in the human form of life, we have the possibility to inquire about and pursue higher principles, that also we can accept as a self-evident fact. It's not possible to discuss philosophy or the quest for higher knowledge with animals. So it's possible in the human form of life. The basic principles of religion, cleanliness, mercy, truthfulness, and austerity. These, I'm presenting these as universal principles.
But
not
they also do the same, right?
Hmm?
They also do the same. They also talk them as
all right. Universals. Yeah, okay.
Can we come to an agreement of universals?
Yeah. So, yeah. Now, the animals cannot appreciate these principles of cleanliness, mercy, truthfulness, and austerity. Human beings can. So human beings that don't follow these principles are, in many ways, in terms of their consciousness, like animals. So they're ineligible for practice of religion. So these are the basic principles. At the lower levels, the basic universal principles are there. One point which I didn't have time to discuss is the need at a certain level we can talk in a logical manner of self-evident principles. But the very nature of reality, of ultimate reality, is that it's not evident to us at the present time. So beginning from self-evident principles, we have to go to principles which is the truth, but it's not evident to us at the present time due to our contaminated consciousness or incomplete understanding. So one universal principle is that we have to receive knowledge from a higher source. That there is understanding which is beyond the normal or mundane level of consciousness, which has to be communicated to us from a higher source. And that is a principle of all religions. The Buddha spoke and others followed. Hazrat Muhammad spoke, before him so many other prophets spoke, and others followed him. Jesus Christ spoke, and others followed. They spoke of reality at a level of understanding or a level of perception higher than that which we are presently experiencing. So that knowledge of that beyond our ordinary experience, on ultimate knowledge of reality, has to be received from a higher source. That is a universal principle. So we're all religions, whether they articulate that or not, they all accept that. Now, what is spoken by various prophets or avatars or that may appear to be different, and it may be different according to the level of eligibility of the people they're speaking to. And in every case, whatever is spoken by prophets or avatars is always interpreted by persons who didn't really connect with that higher level of consciousness. And then we get religion as we know it today. That's why we're trying to discuss philosophically. It doesn't, even the very greatest, best, purest teacher, whatever he says will be misinterpreted. And mostly religion means the giving the name of someone and then quoting what he said or misquoting it, and then misquoting his quote or quoting a misquote. So that we end up, religion as it's practiced in the world generally doesn't have much to do with what those who were teaching it originally had to give to us. So, yes, there are universal principles, and all the genuine teachers, they teach the same universal principles, but there are many non-genuine teachers also. So they all speak, they're all coming from the same source. But again, the level of what they spoke, it's knowledge coming from above, and the level of what they spoke, that also depends on the level of the persons they were speaking to. Generally, we can understand, to some extent, we can understand the level of eligibility of the persons being spoken to by the level of their mercifulness, truthfulness, cleanliness, and austerity. If that's on a low level, then the level of philosophy or exposition of truth that is given is also not likely to be on a very high level. Just like the same we can give a mundane example. Again, I've given it several times. We can teach mathematics at various levels to according to the eligibility of those who are of the students. So, although all religions, they're based on the same universal principles, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're all on the same, that they're all teaching exactly the same thing, or they're all teaching the same level of truth or understanding of truth. That might sound contentious in a divided world. And everyone wants to claim that we have the truth and this is it, this is the highest. I also think that what I have to speak is the highest exposition of the highest reality. But I don't want to, if I didn't think I was had the highest thing to give, then I should be searching for that. But I believe, as the popular word, I believe, although truth is not subject to our belief, I believe that I have found the highest path. But at the same time, I don't find any use to just dogmatically try and beat people that this is the highest, you should accept it. But rather, we're trying to present that this is reality as it's perceived by persons on this on a higher level of understanding. So we invite others to consider this with their intelligence. And if they like, they can adopt it also. It's not something you can force. You can, by various forceful means and even tricks, you can spread religion. But actual connection with the highest truth cannot come by any such means. It has to come from the heart, actually. We're discussing philosophy, which is an intellectual process. But ultimately, we're talking about our needs. The need for water is fulfilled by water. The need for food is fulfilled by food. So our ultimate need is for love. So love is not something that can be forced or propagated. So education means, the root meaning of this term is to bring out that which is already within us. So spiritual education means to awaken within us our natural feelings of love for the actual object of love. So universal principles are there, yes. But that doesn't mean necessarily that all paths are on an equal level. They're all all genuine paths are meant for the ultimate good. That's true. But there may be levels also. And again, we should be careful of false prophets. There are many persons claiming to propagate the truth, or persons who claim themselves to be the truth. We should be very careful. Because people are not interested in philosophy, they can be easily misled. We're talking that the ultimate level is love. But love is blind. Well, if we're going to pursue the path of love, we should use some the head should also be involved. Intelligence is also required. Otherwise, we can be misled. So many people, India, we're talking about India's technological development, but India's for centuries been, or at least in the last few centuries, been a factory of avatars, so-called avatars. So we should be careful. There's so many claiming to be God. But then again, we have the Vedic literature, which gives what are the characteristics of an actual avatar. It's not just that anyone can claim to be an avatar and then people they foolishly accept because someone shows some little magic tricks. Yeah, other questions?
I believe there are many questions. People have many questions here. So please introduce yourself when you ask a question.
Is it? Do we have a cordless mic or this mic?
Okay. Actually, you have used the word illegible so much that I'm almost becoming afraid whether I'm eligible to ask the question.
Eligibility to ask questions depends on sincerity.
Okay.
There are two kinds of questions. One question is to elucidate the truth, and another is to avoid the truth. Okay. So sincerity means the question to elucidate the truth.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me present that I'm eligible. I've heard you saying that philosophy is religion, and religion is philosophy.
Mm.
I wouldn't know if that is a personal opinion or generally accepted opinion. And then, listening to your presentations too, I appear to have listened and seen you talking differently about philosophy and differently about religion.
Mm.
I don't know whether it's in my mind, but that's what I'm getting. But yes, you started by saying that philosophy is religion.
Yeah.
I don't know whether is it in order of essence or in order of implication. Then again, I see the sign among your group. I don't know what it means. I would like...
Sign? Oh, this. Tilak, yeah.
Get the real
you're the second person to ask that.
I mean, what...
What it signifies. Okay.
From your own
okay. All right. So I was saying that philosophy is religion and religion is philosophy, but in my discussion, it seems that I've been just talking of philosophy as one thing and religion as something else. Yeah, actually, one very important part of philosophy is properly defining terms. Just like we may ask, someone may ask you, do you believe in God? So, first of all, we should define what we mean by God, because you may say, I may say, I believe in God, but I don't believe in the God you believe in. So what do we mean by philosophy? What do we mean by religion? What do we mean that they're the same? Yeah, they're the same in as much as they ultimately serve this, they ultimately come to the same purpose. Although, at the higher level, philosophy merges into religion. And religion cannot be without philosophy. And ultimately, religion and philosophy, even beyond what we perceive as religion and philosophy, is the pure activity of, or an experience of the soul, which is simply to love Krishna. But as we go down, or as we're at the more basic level, then we see, seen from different perspectives. It's actually philosophy and religion, they're ultimately meant for understanding the highest truths, but there are different words, which means they should be something different, isn't it? If there are different words, so it means they're two different things. So they are, but they are two different approaches to approach the same thing, which is ultimately encompasses all philosophy and all religion. So yes, they are different at our present level of perception. We treat them at least somewhat differently, but ultimately they're meant for the same thing. And what's this? This is called tilak. It's symbolic of the wearers being a devotee of Krishna. His whole existence is dedicated to Krishna. It's particular, this is made from a particular clay which comes from a particular holy place. And the benefit of applying this with mantra, it's not just here. There are 12 parts of the body. Here, 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 here. Like this. So this is applied with mantra, which invokes the protection and blessings of and remembrance of Krishna. And it also helps others who are familiar with this to remind them of Krishna. Reminding them of Krishna, who means the ultimate truth, the highest reality, God, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Reminding others of Him is also beneficial for them. So it has various purposes. It's a great culture.
Thank you. And many people are coming, so we usually close at 9:30, so we have some 35 minutes. And I myself like to apologize. I am infant's question bank. I have many questions myself. I will make only two today. So in between maybe commercial break time. So now we go to Professor Fernando. Professor Fernando has a question.
Professor from?
His name is Professor Fernando.
Oh, Fernando. India. I saw.
I teach philosophy at Assumption University. Thank you very much for your very interesting discourse on philosophy and religion. You began with universal principles. That was a very good beginning. Although you quoted the Vedic slogans, Vedic statements, but then you tried to show us the universal application of the Vedic principles. That was very nice to listen to.
Thank you.
But then, you ended up in a sectarian manner. That's in my opinion.
Well, I didn't. The point is, I didn't have time. I had to make a big. I said I had to make a big jump.
Yeah. Because you named the, you gave a name to the transcendent reality. So there, you sounded a bit sectarian. I was a bit
disappointed. Well, it may the ultimate reality has a name may sound sectarian. But then the ultimate reality is ultimately beyond our conceptions of what that reality should be. So if the ultimate reality does have a name, and we deny that, then we're not in contact with the ultimate reality. The point I wanted to make, which I didn't have enough time to make, is that we have to receive knowledge of the ultimate reality from those who have it. And that the ultimate reality is a person. It's not just a concept or an impersonal force. It needs quite a few steps to go through that. But if we are to accept that the ultimate... Well, it's not so difficult to understand. If we see that everything is ordered within this universe, and that that suggests that there's an orderer, that there's ultimate meaning. And meaning doesn't come about simply by chance or chaos. So if we are to accept that the Supreme is a person, then the person has a name also. Maybe many names. Why only one name? So it's perceived as, it may be perceived as sectarian because different people are giving different or proposing different names. So then we may say, well, the ultimate has no name, but then denying, because we don't know the name or we think that no one can know the name, to deny the name of the ultimate reality is falling short of reality. Krishna actually means all attractive. So ultimate reality is all attractive. We may see this as sectarian if we consider worship of Krishna as part of Hinduism, as it's generally considered. We consider it as, it's considered as part of Hinduism because of our, because of man's inability to understand higher reality and his need to categorize everything in terms that he understands. Although Krishna is ultimately beyond material terms of understanding. This is actually one of the features of worship of Krishna, which is repeatedly in the highest literature of Vaishnavism, Srimad Bhagavatam. This point is brought out again and again, how the ultimate reality, who is sought after life by yogis and philosophers, is playing as a young child, running around in the house of his apparent father. It totally throws our intelligence out. It's boggling to the intelligence that the ultimate, because the ultimate reality is all love, but that love is also, it's not just something vague, but it's intimate and personal. That means we have a personal exchange with the Supreme Person. That, what is that personal exchange? Feeding him, even though he feeds everyone. Offering him flowers, even though he makes all the flowers. So this is, that's why I say it's ultimately beyond philosophy and ultimately beyond religion. If we find it difficult to understand, it's not difficult to understand if we find it difficult to understand, because even great yogis and philosophers, they also find it difficult to understand, even after many lifetimes of trying. But if we are to study impartially and take it step by step, we will find that Krishna is the... And if we're favored with mercy from him, because ultimately it's coming down. We can't climb up. We can't bring out tanks and guns and say, we're going to take over the absolute truth by force. We can't do that. If he allows, he will allow us to understand him. So we claim to have a non-sectarian universal approach. Others may do so also, but then we have to examine and see which concept it does present reality in the highest form. And we have to see if it works also. It's not just some theory or concept. There should be a process to understand it. That's the religion that goes with the philosophy. And then by practicing that we should actually experience religion and philosophy without... Experience is only talk. So ultimately we have to experience Krishna. Yeah, sorry, we're covering volumes in a few words here.
I let you speak. So actually my first question was what Dr. Fernando said, to continue that point. Your terminal point of your presentation was about, you did mention about semantic God, that it is not that semantic God, but it is Krishna.
I didn't say semantic, actually. I said Semitic.
Semitic?
Means the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim
Semitic God, yes.
Concept.
Middle Eastern religion.
Yeah, they all come from the same geographical
so
and philosophical
and
background.
It's Krishna. I just wonder, long time ago when I was in the southern part of India in one train, then I was a young kid, and I met one person, an elderly man, he belonged to your movement, and he talked to me, we are open for every religion. And I was shocked then. And then I came to Bangkok, I had another encounter. I do like food from your restaurant, Salah. I'm a loyal customer. I always go to Krishna restaurants for food. So there I met this guy, and he also said, I don't know what you have, a common thing which you can offer to all faiths of the world. Because what he claimed, and many did claim before, that we are open for every faith, we are open for everybody, and here you said, it's not that God, it's Krishna. I wonder, is it like Buddhistic Nirvana, or is it Hinduistic Brahma? And this new term, Krishna, and how it go together, and what could be a common? Then you say, like, Krishna, you give it a name, and why it can't...
No, we don't give a name. If the truth has a name, we cannot deny that name.
But how can you justify that this can be Krishna? Others can justify too.
Well, that's what I was saying. There comes a point, logic and philosophy can take us so far. Logically, we can understand that there must be a supreme being. Just like you may come to a country. I just came to Thailand today. Of course, it's not the first time I came. It's the first time I came here for about maybe 18, 19 years. You know, I used to come regularly. So if you land in a country, you can understand that there must be some system of government. There must be some head of state, whether he's called the president, prime minister, military ruler, or whatever. So that much you can understand. By logic, it's easy to understand that there must be some ruler in this state. But who is he? What is his name? What does he like to eat for breakfast? How does he dress? What are his opinions? That you cannot understand by logical inference, because that a person by definition means he has a specific personality which is unique. So that the Supreme is a person or God is accepted in the Semitic religions. The Supreme Being. God is defined in the Oxford Dictionary as the Supreme Being. But who he is, actually, what does he look like? Is a person should look like something, should and has have a name and friends and like to eat certain things and not other things. So this we cannot deduce by logic. Now there's a new ruler in Thailand. What's his name? General Sir something? Somchi? Somti. All right. So, what does he like to eat? You cannot deduce that by logic. You might guess that because he's a Thai, he likes to eat rice and noodles. So that would be a good guess. But what's his favorite food? There are certain things that you cannot, they're beyond logic. So logic can take us to a certain level, but then we have to find out. Now, No doubt the people of Thailand are going to find out, and of other parts of the world, they're going to find out more about him than they did it, than they knew previously, because he's now got a much more important position than he had. So they'll find out when he goes to another country, then they'll find. I'm just speaking theoretically here, I'm not making any political statement. Could be dangerous at the present time. Or if the head of state, let's not say general something, if the head of state goes to another country and they'll invite him for a banquet, they'll find what he likes to eat and what he's allergic to and all this kind of thing. So how are they going to find out? Well, you should find out from someone who knows. Maybe his... If you want to find out about any person, you have to find out from someone who knows them. So that there is a Supreme Person, we can discuss philosophically and establish that. Of course, some people would argue. But then what is his name? What is that he has personal preferences which make him the unique person he is? That we can also understand logically. But what those unique characteristics are not understandable by logic. They have to be simply accepted by people who know. So, Krishna is the Supreme. The Supreme has to be something, someone. And according to the Vedic literature, if you wish to accept it, there should be some knowledge. There should be something which tells us about this. Otherwise, it will always remain beyond us. So that's why there's scripture. Scripture informs us of the reality that we cannot deduce by logic. It also gives logic to help us along the way. But the scripture and those who understand scripture, they explain to us, at the highest level, they explain to us that the absolute truth is like this. There's so much, this much you can understand. What you don't understand, it fills in. So Krishna has various avatars in his original form. He is bluish. His bodily complexion is dark. His favorite musical instrument is a flute. His favorite animal is the cow. He has his girlfriend, which is, that's what I'm saying, it's astonishing. But it's not immoral. Now we're going up a long, long way. If we're looking from down here, everything looks back to front. When our vision comes around the other way, we'll see that Krishna's girlfriend, that is the highest platform of purity. But if we look from this world, it looks to us impure. So this is very high philosophy.
Well, what about the disciples of Krishna? Someone is, do they have girlfriends? They should follow Krishna, right?
Yeah. Krishna has friends. In this immaterial existence, we have limited friendship. Ayang nijaf paroveti ganana laghu chetasam. People of narrow-minded vision, they see this is mine, this is someone else's. I'm a Thai. That's which people don't the Thais like. Burmese, traditionally, they had so many wars with the Burmese. So we're Thai, we don't like the Burmese. We're Buddhist, we don't like the Muslims. So this kind of thinking is persons of small consciousness. But udara charitanam tu vasudhaiva kutumbakam. One who has got broad vision sees everyone as his family. He doesn't differentiate. This is mine, they're in a different group. I like him, I hate him. Not like that. So this is real broad-mindedness.
You. Because of time constraint, we could allow only one or two questions. So please, go ahead.
So I'm Rivi, I come from Burma. So I'm a student here, studying, religion. So my question is, for you, ultimate truth is to enter the eternal relationship with Krishna, right?
No, not for me.
Okay, or your follower?
No. Ultimate truth, it is not dependent upon me or what I think or anyone else thinks. Ultimate truth is by its very nature independent of what any of us think. So when we're speaking about the truth, it's not a matter of personal belief. It's a universal principle for everyone. So it's not, if at all we are to discuss the truth, then we should understand that it's not a question of belief. It's not a matter of my personal path, but it applies to everyone.
It's really very difficult for other people to accept this. Anyway, my question is...
It may be difficult, but that doesn't disqualify. It's just like to understand atomic physics. It's not everyone's going to understand, but that doesn't mean that the principles of atomic physics are not true because most people can't understand them. But at the same time, because this is a universal principle, if we discuss it philosophically, it may seem difficult. But actually, because it is a universal principle, it is natural for everyone. Therefore, when we finished all this discussion, we'll chant Hare Krishna again. And then even without understanding all the philosophy, you can immediately come to the platform of the highest truth.
So
even without understanding it.
So do you also have restrictions? Is that to understand this by birth or by training? And in this case, what is the role of Buddhists? Are they like the monks in Buddhism or quite different?
Yeah, as I was saying at the beginning, because we're in a Buddhist environment, we'll get questions from the Buddhist perspective. And if we're in an Islamic country, we'll get questions comparing with Islam. So, are there restrictions? Yes, certainly. That I was saying that mercy, truth, eligibility depends upon our advancement in mercy, mercifulness, truthfulness, cleanliness, austerity. So that means there are some restrictions. If we're living like animals, then we cannot come to the higher platform. So there are some restrictions. In our Krishna consciousness movement, there are certain restrictions. No meat eating, no gambling, no illicit sex, no intoxication. Because these destroy mercy, cleanliness, truthfulness, and austerity. So no meat eating, no gambling. Obviously, someone who's interested in higher values, there's no gambling, there's no meat. No illicit sex, which means that sex is allowed, not for monks, of course, but one may pursue this path as a layman or laywoman within married life. And sex is not meant to be just for some recreation, but for procreation of good children. And no intoxication, because this destroys... Intoxication destroys discrimination and destroys all good qualities. So there are some restrictions. There are do's and do nots. There are rules to follow which help us to... discipline our lives and discipline our consciousness so that we can perceive the highest truth. And about gurus, their roles compared to monks in the Buddhist tradition, that's a very big cultural question, which I'll just briefly say, to some extent yes and to some extent no. It's a very big question.
All right. We don't have now much time and we have to do some formal things. And then you have a lot of prashad, there are delicious prashad still left. So after we close, then you can have it again on my invitation. Is that all right? So now what we